little over a month ago, I lost my dear love, my soulmate, Ramona. And so this is going to be inevitable. It's going to be inevitable that that subject is going to come up. And I have a few things to sort of tell you, run by you, and certainly run by Diane. So we'll see how this goes. It's going to be about communication with those who have passed on. And it's coming up in a moment. I did indeed lose my soulmate a little over a month ago now, and I told you when it came in I would give you the results after even the deep tissue samples came back. My dear wife died of severe asthmatic chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Asthma. She went in her sleep. And so I have that to hold on to, and I'm going to dispense with anything else other than to tell you, if you have a husband or you have a wife and you're listening to me right now, don't ever go to bed at night without telling the person you're with you love them. Don't ever do that. I have little to hang on to. I have the fact that in 15 years, my wife and I never were apart. We were as close as two people can possibly be. And the day of her passing, I put my arms around her, and as I did every day, I gave her a kiss and said, "Honey, I love you." And that was the last time I saw her. So if there is a message, and there is, don't ever let that day pass, because you have to know it can always be the last day. Now, Diane is a Southerner, as you're going to detect right away. Diane, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Art. Especially at this time of your life, I really appreciate it.
How does somebody like you get a last name like Archangel? I mean, you've had to have taken a lot of ribbing about that.
I haven't. Actually, it's very common in Italy. It was my husband's name. And by the way, you and I have that in common. My husband also died 2 years ago unexpectedly.
I'm so sorry.
So we're going to hang in here together.
Okay. I read in your book that your husband was a skeptic. In fact, he really didn't believe particularly in an afterlife. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Was absolutely positive there was no afterlife.
Oh, that's different. Absolutely positive. Now, how did he get? Can you explain to me how he could have been absolutely positive?
I cannot explain it to you. He just was sure. However, he was the biggest supporter of my work. From everyone I knew, he supported it more than anyone, because he saw the difference in believing and in not believing.
He did. In other words, he saw value in people believing but did not himself?
That's right, Art. He saw whenever someone believed, they didn't have the fear of death like he did. He had such a fear of death, because he said, when we die, that's it, there is no more. We talked about it quite a bit.
Well, you must have asked him and said, "Honey, how are you coming to that conclusion?"
He said he didn't know. He just didn't believe.
Well, then it's like an article of faith.
There you go.
And yet he supported your work because he felt that it helped people.
He did. In fact, several of his friends came to me after losing children, and I worked with them, and he saw the difference that it made when they believed, and especially after they had had an afterlife encounter.
That is such an unusual position, very unusual, actually. But I guess that's great. He supported your work. Now, you have worked with the best. I mean, I've looked carefully at where you've been, and you know the people you've worked with. For example, I think a friend of mine in Las Vegas, perhaps, eh?
Right, absolutely.
Mr. Bigelow.
That's right, Bob Bigelow.
Yeah, you've worked with some with the heavyweights in this area. So I've got a lot of respect for what you're about to say. But, you know, I must tell you, Diane, I think that, on balance, I believe there is another side. But I'm not positive. There is this hard science part of me, Diane, that is injecting doubts into it. So... But I think I believe. How about that? That's about as close as I can get.
You sound pretty much like me.
Really? You've done all the research, and I guess you have many stories to tell. I'm sure you do. But that's you, huh? You're not absolutely certain, even after all you've researched?
Well, I'll tell you, after all my research, in fact, I have over 10,000 cases in my files. I myself have had a near-death experience.
Really?
And what I believe is that consciousness survives. Now, for how long, where it goes, that's what I'm not sure of. But I do really honestly believe it survives.
Well, that too is interesting. You're injecting sort of the possibility that consciousness may survive, but not for long?
I don't know how long. I believe some people reincarnate. However, it doesn't seem that everyone does. I'll tell you, we are so much just on the cutting edge of trying to understand what afterlife encounters are, what survival is, what consciousness is. I mean, we're just now beginning to understand the brain. Well, the mind is so much, it's vast in comparison.
Boy, I'm with you on that. We're moving into areas of consciousness research and all the rest of it that are probably going to meet up with, I don't know, what scientists are talking about with regard to other dimensions and all sorts of things. It's like the whole world is ahead of us and open in this area. And finally, we're beginning to move into it and investigate it. And it's sort of coming out of the closet a little bit. So there are some exciting things happening. Do you imagine, Diane, that one day communication with consciousness not encased in a physical body will be possible?
I don't know. I would like to think that it is. And when we say we're just at this cutting edge, an example of that is that I did a 5-year international study. Now, Art, I had heard about afterlife encounters and how healing they were and how comforting they were, but when I said I want to know specifically how comforting, what do they do, how does it help with the grief, I turned to my colleagues in the paranormal field, in the psychology field, and bereavement. We looked through all the literature, and not one study had ever been done that focused on specifically, are they comforting? How do they help grief? That's why I turned and began doing my study.
Well, I believe, Diane, they are comforting, and obviously they would help grief, but are they real? That's the question.
Well, in my book, one chapter is devoted to what is the evidence.
All right, let's stop right there, and why don't you tell me, what is the evidence?
All right. The evidence is, I listed 6 conditions in my books. Number one, is when the apparition states unknown information.
Yes.
To the witness.
Right.
The witness then proves that later. I'll give you an example. In my book, Beverly, a mother, had a terrible feeling one night when her son Tommy wanted to go out. He went out anyway. Terrible, terrible snowstorm. She said when he wasn't home by about midnight, she began calling the hospitals. Sure enough, the next morning, the police arrived at her door, said, "We are so sorry to tell you this, but Tommy was murdered."
Oh my God.
They went inside, sat down in her living room. They began telling her the problem was that Tommy was murdered, but then his body was transported. They said no crime scene, no witnesses, no suspects. Said there's nothing we can do. This will probably be a cold case. Well, Beverly began crying, of course, and saying, Tommy, Tommy, who would do this to you? She said overhead the chandelier in her living room shuddered and vibrated so violently that the police at one time stopped her. They were afraid that a fire was going to break out. They continued. All right, still, like I said, no suspects, nothing they could do, cold case.
Right.
The day after the funeral, Beverly's relatives were still there. She called the police department. They said, we're sorry, there's just not anything we can do. We don't have any kind of crime scene, nothing. That morning, Tommy came to his mother, said, Mom, Mom, hurry, wake up, wake up. You'll find my blood in the snow at Washington and St. James Place, but you've got to go right now. It's going to melt. Beverly went running down the stairs. Her family thought she was crazy with grief, but she insisted. They drove to the exact site where Tommy said his blood would be found in the snow, and there it was, melting, exactly like he said.
Wow.
Beverly said, Diane, yeah, I couldn't call the police and tell them my dead son told me this. So she said, went to a phone booth, I called them and said I had an anonymous tip. Sure enough, the police came out. They took the DNA samples. It was Tommy's blood. But here, Art, is the thing, is that from there, the police found three eyewitnesses. All three eyewitnesses told exactly what happened with Tommy.
Wow.
Someone, a man, was trying to rob him, chased him round and round and round the van until finally, of course, they were stabbing him as he was running, but then they took his billfold and they took his ring, threw him in the van, and sped off.
Right.
This is the thing. They said, can you tell us the suspect's name? They said, all we know is his nickname was Light.
Oh.
Ah, there was the light shaking overhead in Beverly's chandelier.
Wow.
Now that's just,
All right, that's very impressive. I'll give you that. It's very impressive. How sure are you of the accuracy of that story?
Every story that's listed in the book, I checked it out. I either asked for like police reports, witnesses, some type of verification.
All right, you obviously really did your homework then. You're not just relating a story. You're telling me you checked, you verified with police or whatever that this really did happen. That's very impressive. That's very impressive.
And that's just a quick overview of her story. It went on and on and on with the dog. And it was just, to me, of all the stories, they're all interesting and they're all very profound in some way. But Beverly, the way she wrote that, it's just, I'm there with her. I'm running with the dog. I'm running down the street. Just fascinating.
All right, here's something I want to ask you about. There are Buddhists, for example, who believe that if a loved one dies, that you have some number of days, maybe 20, 21 days, in order to concentrate hard on this person and invite their spirit into you. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because there are many who think that when somebody passes, that their spirit is more connected to Earth, you know, for some period of time, some relatively short period of time before they move on more reasonably. Do you believe that?
Well, there's part of that and part of that I don't. I do not believe that there are earthbound spirits, and that strictly comes from my research. In over my 10,000 case studies, I have never had one report of an apparition who was earthbound, who was stuck here.
Well, okay, but it's...
Now, what you're saying is different. You're saying they're inviting them in.
Yes.
So, inviting, yes, we can invite. And I hear the word conjure a lot.
Yes.
We cannot conjure. If they want to come in and help us, they can.
Okay.
There's only one reason that an afterlife encounter takes place. That's when the apparition wants to come in and help everyone for their highest and best good. Everyone involved.
Huh. So let me ask it a different way then. Is there a period of time, I shouldn't have said earthbound, is there a period of time when the spirit, or while the spirit, is more connected to what the spirit just left than it ultimately will be?
There does not seem to be a period of time when they're most connected. From what I understand, and just, like I said, from years of research, right now it appears that when the spirit leaves the body, it goes up. There's absolutely nothing below that it is connected to. It goes up of its own free will. Now, it can return here of its own free will, but it's completely disconnected, disassociated from all things on Earth.
And you're suggesting the direction is always up?
It is up.
So what about traditional biblical hell and the trip down?
You know, and here again, it's just in my case studies of over 10,000, I've never found anything negative, anything hellacious, anything other than positive love, light, healing. In fact, I had a call this afternoon. Somebody found from your website called me and said, how can I get in touch with my mom? I've just begged, I've pleaded, I've tried everything I can to get her to come in and see me. But you know, Art, they're so used to love, light, peace, and joy, they won't come down to anything that's what they consider grasping or clinging. They're not used to that. They're only used to positive love, light, peace, and joy.
Okay, so you conclude then from 10,000 studies that there is no hell?
I have not found a hell.
Well, I don't know. That's kind of comforting, I suppose. on the other hand, though, perhaps you would not find those kinds of cases because they're gone and burning.
That could very well be.
Okay. All right. So you wrote this book, Afterlife Encounters. I wonder what prompted you to write it. I mean, to decide to write a book is a really big thing to do. It's a big decision, and I'm curious why you did it.
You got that right. It was a major decision. I'll tell you, I did it to change worldview.
The worldview?
The worldview.
Oh, that's no minor hope. Once again, Diane Archangel, who has written a book, that's no small matter, Aliens on the Mind, Afterlife Encounters, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Experiences, Life After Loss. Boy, life after loss. So, Diane, before we plunge into changing the worldview, define for me what you think the present world view is. I mean, we have a rather narrow idea of it all here in the U.S. What is the world view with regard to afterlife communications?
Right now, the world view is the living have our world and the other side has theirs. And these two don't mix. And it's simply the basis of fear of the unknown. They don't know what they are. So to change worldview, we've got to extinguish this cycle, what I call disenfranchisement. People who experience afterlife encounters don't talk about them in public because listeners will discount them. Listeners discount them because they don't understand what they are.
Right.
And they don't understand what they are because experiencers don't talk about them. It's that cycle. Someone has to break the cycle. That's what we're trying to do. 90 people joined me in the book, and some wonderful colleagues. Rupert Sheldrake, I'm sure you probably are familiar with Rupert.
I've interviewed him.
Sure, he's a biologist from London. He joined me. We just want to stamp out this cycle.
And replace it with?
Replace it with the truth. The truth is, afterlife encounters are normal, they're healthy, and if the public can just understand that, we can change worldview. Then everyone can talk about them openly, honestly, because the fact is, they bring healing to everyone, not just the bereaved.
They bring healing to everybody. In other words, a universal understanding of the fact that it is occurring. But Diane, to change that worldview, you're going to have to go back to the chapter on proof.
All right, let's go back to the chapter on proof. Those six conditions. All right, we've already talked about the first condition with Beverly, where an apparition told unknown information proven correct later.
Very impressive, yes.
The second condition, whereby we find evidence for life after death, is collective. In other words, when more than one person witnesses the apparition. An example of this is Charles Vance. Charles Vance is a very wealthy businessman in Houston. He's successful. He's just not the type you would ever think would have anything like an afterlife encounter.
Right.
He's busy. He pushes through. He's kind of a bull. And a friend of mine told me that Charles Vance had encountered Murphy.
Who?
Now,
who?
Murphy. Now, what surprised me about this was Murphy owned a little tiny vacuum cleaner store. He took an old, not even brick home, just a little frame house. In the front of it, he put his vacuum cleaner store and parts. In the back, he lived with his wife and children.
Uh-huh.
No one would ever dream Murphy had any money. Well, according to this friend of mine, Charles Vance had this apparitional experience with Murphy, and Murphy told him there was an astonishing amount of money he had hidden in the wall. Yes, and he wanted Charles to call his widow and tell her.
Tell her, sure.
Sure, break down the wall, get the money. Well, Charles said, I can't do something like that. They would think I was nuts.
Stay good and close to the phone for me.
Okay.
So, this is impressive stuff. Something that only the person who had passed away could possibly know, and a secret they held, like where money's stored or stashed or something, yeah.
Right, and I mean, and Art, I had probably, I don't know, maybe 200 cases in my files with money hidden in the rafters, hidden in the basement, hidden in jars. But what attracted me to this account was, number one, Murphy. I mean, he wore old overalls that were holy and shirts that were just hanging.
Yeah.
You would never dream he had a dime. So I went over and talked to Charles, interviewed him and his wife. Now, Jean, his wife, said Charles would not have ever told anybody about this, never.
I can believe that, sure.
But Murphy kept coming to him more often and more often and more often. Tell Lorraine there's money. Tell Lorraine there's money.
All right, now, did Murphy know him?
Murphy had been his boss at one time. Charles went over and would just help him around the store.
All right, so there was
when he was in high school.
There was a relationship.
There
okay.
was a relationship.
That's fine, good.
Yes. So, finally, Charles Vance's wife called the widow, told the widow. Of course, she just kind of laughed it off. But then she called back, and much to their surprise, she said she was going to tear down that wall the next week anyway to have the house redone. So she decided to go ahead and knock a hole in there. Art, she found thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in cash. So now, this is why it was collective. The widow called the daughter who lived in Florida. Now, this was in Houston.
Yes.
Called the daughter in Florida, said, you won't believe this, I found money. And the daughter said, Mom, Dad has been coming to me in dreams, telling me. And then she described the exact scene, word for word, the leaves in the trees, what the house looked like. There was a sign Murphy was standing by that Charles had described. So the daughter described word for word, verbatim, what Charles had already told his wife. So here we have a person in Houston, a person in Florida, the same apparitional account at the same time. So that's collective. And that, again, is just a very quick synopsis of the story. It's really long.
Yeah, that's very impressive. And you, again, you checked it out very carefully.
Absolutely. Checked it out very carefully.
All right. Well, I mean, that seems to be clear evidence that some consciousness obviously survives and can get a message across. Yes?
Yes. That's the second. Now, the third condition that we consider as evidence is when the apparition is unknown to the witness at the time.
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
But it is later identified.
Okay.
Let me think. Okay, one example is also in the book, and this, again, is a very quick synopsis. Debbie Fancher is a high school teacher here in Houston. She called me one morning, told me that she was having this dream of this young girl, beautiful, beautiful young girl, a teenager. And the teenager kept saying, "Tell my dad not to feel guilty. Be sure and go tell my dad not to feel guilty." Debbie said, "The problem is I don't think it's a dream, and I have a horrible, horrible feeling it's an apparition, but I don't know who this girl is."
Huh.
Debbie and I talked back and forth. Finally, she said, the only teenager that she knew that had even been sick was her high school principal's daughter.
Right.
But he was brand new to the school. She knew nothing about him except somebody mentioned that his daughter was sick. She had some type of infection, but no big deal. Debbie said, I said, "Well, can you go back to school? And don't ask if the daughter died, but can you say, how is the principal's daughter doing?"
Sure.
Debbie did. She went back to school, found out that, in fact, her name was Amanda, that she did not survive the infection. Debbie was at school some weeks later, walking down the hall, looked up, and here was this exact duplicate of the girl who had been coming to her in her dreams.
Mm.
Another teacher was standing there and said, Debbie, you look like you've seen a ghost. Debbie said, I think I have. She said, "Oh, no. That was Amanda's sister."
Hmm.
They're identical, almost like twins. Of course, they're sisters, but they look like twins. They're so much alike. Like you said, Art, I went, checked out all these stories. Debbie invited me to meet with the principal, his wife, and their two children.
Yes.
They verified that, in fact, Amanda was so identical to the sister that when they were in high school, the teachers and the students confused the two of them all the time. And the thing that was so outstanding that Debbie said she just thought it was something in her imagination was, why would a dad feel guilty when his daughter had succumbed to some kind of an illness? But they, in fact, verified that as well, that he did. I won't go, it's personal, so I won't go into why, but he did.
Huh. If, you know, these stories you're telling me are really beyond the pale. I mean, they really would suggest we're looking at proof here, Diane. And since you're the one who's done the investigative work in many cases in nailing down the truth of these stories, I wonder how you can be left with any doubt at all about the whole question of communication, or do you not have any doubt? I mean, earlier you suggested that maybe you did. So I can't, how could you do these investigations and still have doubt?
Oh, what a great question.
Yeah.
It's because I haven't had one. And when
well,
I begin,
didn't you say at the very beginning of the interview you've had an NDE?
I have, but and during my near-death experience, I did see apparitions. I talked with God. But, I mean, in my waking state, in my life here, in my normal life, I have not had an afterlife encounter. So, yeah, I turn, in fact, we're talking about why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I wanted to change worldview. I had these 90 people saying, "Let's go for it. Let's do it. Let's all take a stand together. We've got to stop the cycle." My colleagues, let's go, let's do it. But you know, I had just lost my husband.
Yes.
And there was all this turmoil going around. And Art, I want you to know, I wrote it for them. I wrote to try to help the world, to try to make it a better place. And the final analysis is, has helped me. This is what's gotten me through. I could honestly say this book is what's gotten me through the toughest time of my life. I turn back to these stories. I read them. I believe them.
All right, Diane, but you did have the experience that you related a moment ago. That would suggest that consciousness survives and indeed can move from the physical. At least it would suggest that much. Of course, that still might be the... what kind of NDE did you really... I mean, what were the physical conditions that produced what you had?
I had had a hysterectomy. I was in the hospital. After surgery, the doctor said they can't understand it. They don't understand why. I simply stopped breathing.
Uh-huh.
Was resuscitated, brought back.
Okay. That definitely qualifies. So I'm not sure how can you come back from that, knowing that you physically did die and you had an experience that you could probably relate to us, I'm sure, in great detail, which included talking to God. I mean, that would seem fairly strong evidence that would give you quite a bit of faith regarding afterlife.
It does, and that's where I would get my belief that, yes, consciousness survives death, but for how long and where it goes, I'm just not that sure. But that's where I really firmly get my belief, and again with the stories in my book.
Well, wouldn't it be a reasonable conclusion that consciousness, if it survives 1 minute outside the physical, would survive eternally, more than likely, outside the physical, absolutely eternally. If it can make 1 minute, it can make forever, can't it?
I believe so. And what is consciousness? It's energy. Energy never dies. It's out there. Gary Schwartz wrote about that in his book, and I know you have interviewed Gary.
I have indeed. Of course, the big question is it coherent?
It's
definitely energy, but energy could be dispersed and non-coherent. And you and I are talking about survival of consciousness. That's very coherent.
Yes. And we say, well, it has to be coherent. It has to be where at least some of them can communicate. I mean, look at Beverly's story with her son Tommy, and Charles with Murphy, and
right.
Debbie with Amanda.
Right. Here's one for you. Does it occur frequently that a departed one contacts somebody absolutely unrelated to the person grieving, for example, and makes a request to have a message passed? Is that a frequent occurrence?
Very frequent, Art.
It is.
It absolutely is very frequent. In fact, that's what we were just talking about with Debbie.
Yes.
Where Amanda came to her and said,
yes.
Here, take this to my dad.
Yes.
It does happen.
And can you imagine the reasons for that? In other words, that perhaps the person is unable to contact their loved one directly, or that person is not receptive enough for that to occur, or what do you imagine, Diane?
I'll tell you, there are a number of reasons. And one is, as you just said, maybe the person is not receptive. It could be that the person is in the throes of grief, simply too much to be open to something like that. It could be, let's say, saying that there is survival, that consciousness survives, that the personality survives. It could be that that personality believes it may be too much, that his or her loved one here on Earth is grieving too much. It would be overwhelming if the apparition came in, the personality came in.
Boy, I'll tell you, Diane, I can underscore that one for you. I've been in this grief process now a little bit over a month, and I've never felt anything like it in my whole life. It's not just mental, it's physical. My God, physical things happen to you when you grieve really hard. I mean, your vision will blur. Weird things happen to you in this process. It, of course, the mind has great control over the body We all know that. And believe me, in a situation like that kind of serious grieving, your mind or something imposes physical problems on you as a result of it, losing weight, just all kinds of things.
Absolutely, Art. In fact, I wrote about that in Life After Loss. The minute we get the message that our loved one has died, there is a chemical release in the brain
that
circulates through our entire body.
Really?
It's the same thing as a physical hit. The people ask me all the time, can you help me? Can you give me advice? I'm not an advice giver. The number one thing I do say, though, is you must drink at least 8 ounces of water every hour.
Every hour?
Every hour. At least 8 ounces.